Welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. Got a bit of an echo here. My name's Keith Bredger. I'm the Hong Kong Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and I'll be your host today on behalf of the Foreign Correspondents Club Professional Committee. Before we get started, let me just make a couple of housekeeping notes. Please, everybody, now turn off your phones, check them. At the very least, please check if they're on mute. We do put up these remarks on YouTube. A lot of people, in fact, now prefer to watch them on YouTube if they're crunched at work or something that day. And so they really don't like to have it blotted out by somebody's cell phone. Next, let me mention, we have not put the flyer out yet, but we will have an event next Monday. I know it's the middle of a four-day weekend, but it will be done in conjunction with the Hong Kong Tennis Association. And we expect to have one or more stars speaking on next Monday in connection with the Hong Kong Tennis Tournament. One or more professionals. With that, let me introduce Dr. Wickery. Dr. Wickery, for starters, had the shortest walk to come give an FCC speech I've heard in all my years here. We've had governors back before 1997. We've had each chief executive coming from the governor's residence, but he only had to go from one Lower Albert Road to two Lower Albert Road, which is our address. He works across the street, diagonally across the street in the bishop's house, the Anglican bishop's house. His trajectory getting there was an interesting one. He grew up speaking Finnish, which is maybe one of the only few languages even harder than Chinese. He didn't grow up speaking Finnish, though, in Finland. He grew up speaking it in Harlem, in a Finnish-speaking enclave in Harlem at the northern end of Manhattan in New York City. Then he went to Taiwan in the early 1970s as a Presbyterian, learned to speak Chinese there, came to China in 1979. He was ordained in 1992 as a priest by the last Anglican bishop, Ting, the last Anglican bishop of mainland China. He is the author of Reconstructing Christianity in China, which came about 6 years ago, particularly looking at the life of Bishop Ting. And he's here to talk to us today about Christianity in China, pathways, problems, and prospects. With that, I give you Dr. Wickery. Thank you.
Thank you very much for inviting me here. I've always wondered what it would be like standing here rather than sitting down there, and I'll know shortly what that was. When I was doing graduate work in Chinese studies, one of my professors liked to say, everything after the Ming Dynasty is newspapers. It was drilled into us that we should look backwards into the Chinese tradition to understand what's happening today. And although we never entirely accepted that view, something about it stuck. I've always wanted to say this at the FCC. Everything after the Ming is newspapers. So please forgive me this indulgence. I've been following religious life in China since 1979, and for much of that time I have lived in Hong Kong or Nanjing, and I've traveled extensively on the mainland. There are many journalists and scholars who know much more about what's happening right now in China than I do. But what I can offer, beyond an understanding of the Ming, is perspective based on long involvement informed by deep and abiding relationships with Chinese Christians, scholars, and officials. I'm a priest and a theology professor, so my views are by no means neutral. But as such, we're taught to read everything and to see everything with a hermeneutic of suspicion. And I think that also informs what I'm going to say here. Earlier this year, a prominent Chinese scholar based in the United States, Yang Fengkang, predicted that China would soon become the largest Christian country in the world. By 2030, he wrote, China's total Christian population, including Catholics, would exceed 247 million. Placing it above Mexico, Brazil, and the US. I am not sure how he arrives at such a prediction, but then again, I've never understood all of the mysteries that sociologists spin for us. But there have been conflicting estimates on the number of Christians in China. The China Daily recently claimed that there may be up to 40 million Protestant Christians, and other good estimates put the number at 58 million. That's Protestant Christians, with an additional 12 to 15 million Roman Catholics. No matter what figures you settle for, it's clear that the church is growing. Up until a few years ago, the official church in China claimed that 7 new churches were opening every day. And if you project that back to 1981, you can do the math and figure out what we're talking about. This growth in Christianity in China has largely been due to the efforts of Chinese Christians themselves, although there have been foreign missionaries who have come into China in various guises as teachers, students, and businessmen, and they have no doubt also contributed to the total. But the growth of Christianity in China is not simply due to the number of adherents. There is also a growing interest in the church in all sectors of society, and a public appreciation and respect for a lived Christianity. One reason I have for being somewhat optimistic about a growing tolerance for the church is that many people, young people, are drawn to Christians that they know who lead humble lives and who care for their neighbors and who do not think that money is the supreme value that we should cherish. In urban areas especially, people know more about Christianity than ever before, and their views are generally positive. This has also led to more and more young people putting themselves forward for Christian service and going for seminary training. More Bibles have been produced in China than ever before. Our Amity Printing Company, started in 1985, has now become the single largest producer of Bibles in the world. Since the establishment of the press in 1987, we've produced 66 million Bibles, not including portions and New Testaments, for distribution in China, including print runs in 9 minority languages. Today, the Bible may be the most widely read book in China. Total Bible production at the end of June 2014 was 123 million, distributed to 70 countries and regions in over 100 different languages. I have been speaking in general terms about Christianity in China, and my focus here is on Protestant Christianity, although I will say things as well about Roman Catholics. But there's been a growing pluralism, especially over the last decade, of what Christianity means. An American academic has recently written about the pluralization of all religious activity in China. In the case of Protestant Christianity, it's no longer accurate to speak of a binary opposition between the so-called official church and underground or unregistered churches. Instead, we can identify at least 3 different forms of Christianity in mainland China, all overlapping, and all of which are themselves diverse, but at the same time distinct in their own ways. And I'll just briefly speak here because of the limitations of time, and we can go into it later. First is institutional Christianity, a much better term than the official church, much more descriptive and much broader. Institutional Christianity includes the Chinese Christian Three Self Patriotic Movement, so-called Three Self Church, the China Christian Council, and on the Catholic side, the Catholic Patriotic Association, Bishops' Council, and related organization. It also includes seminaries and social service organizations related to these. Institutional Christianity in China is part of the political and social system. There's diversity in the theologies of institutional Christianity, but it tends to be conservative and evangelical in approach to matters of belief. It operates according to certain rules and regulations, its own and those of the relevant political structures. It has its own leaders. It's related to the government and party bodies. It cooperates with other institutions in China, and it's related to churches all over the world, including all of the major churches here in Hong Kong. So the second broad category is community-based Christianity. This would include the various Christian meeting points, sometimes called house churches or underground churches, and it's popular especially in rural areas. It may or may not be related to the church institutions, and it's by its very nature quite diverse, including Orthodox and heterodox versions of Christian faith. It may have charismatic leaders, be associated with broader networks, and have unsanctioned relationships with overseas groups. The education of folk Christians in rural areas is quite low, as it is for migrants in the cities. But other community-based churches in the major cities have professional people with very high levels of education and sophisticated theology. The third social form that I'm speaking of is called intellectual Christianity. These people who were once called culture Christians, scholars and academics in various university departments and social science institutes, those who became Christians in Western country and returned to China, the people who generally stand aloof from both the institutional churches and the rural churches, but it includes also popular entertainers, lawyers, and other professional people. Probably the most famous of these Christians was the former secretary of Wen Jiabao, and widely known as a Christian. In academic writings, poetry, art, music, and literature, one can see the development of this institutional intellectual Christianity, and its their ideas are freely circulating in China. I'm including also in this category, which somewhat troubles me because they really belong maybe in a category of their own, the various Christian activists and human rights lawyers, although placing them alongside academics in university who are supportive of state structures doesn't really seem to fit. I've heard the estimate that there may be 300 full-time human rights lawyers in China, and as many, probably more than half of them, are Christian. Many human rights lawyers and activists advocate different forms of public theology in opposition to political authorities, and they are increasingly outspoken, both at home and abroad. Now, these three different overlapping forms are, of course, different from one another, and they both cooperate with one another, and they are opposed to the other ones. There's this tension and conflict. The different forms of community-based Christianity often compete with one another, as well as the institutional church. Leaders of the institution sometimes function as if they were bureaucrats who have grown detached from the churches or complacent, almost like some government officials. The judgment is unfair, in my opinion, but perception is there all the same. I've been speaking here mainly about the Han Chinese majority, but I should also add that some of the national minorities also have very large Christian populations, especially the Miao, the Yi, the Jingpo in southwest China. Theirs is a church of the poor. Now, Africans sometimes say that Christianity in sub-Saharan Africa is 100 miles wide, but only an inch deep. This may also be true of Christianity in China. Some Chinese academics say that Christianity in China has a big body, but a very small head. Christians have been believers for only a few years, most of them, and they often lack a basic understanding of biblical teachings and church practices. They tend to ignore Western Christian traditions, not necessarily a bad thing. And alongside the growth of Christianity in rural area has also become a growth of various sectarian and heretical new movements. Some of these have been in the press recently, specifically the Church of the Almighty God, so-called Eastern Lightning. This group believes that Jesus has already returned to earth as a woman who will save only members of this particular sect. Although the educational level of Protestant pastors of lay and lay leaders in the churches has improved, there are still not enough to go around. And this situation is unlikely to get better anytime soon. The church estimates that there's less than one trained clergyman for every 10,000 people. Even the institutional church is under-institutionalized and without adequate means of communication with the Christian base at the grassroots. And yet, the pluralism and growth of Christianity in China is unprecedented in Chinese history. This is the best environment that there has been for religion in China since the founding of the People's Republic. The stories about repression and continual difficulties notwithstanding, Christianity is more visible than at any time in its long history, in cities and in rural areas, among the old and the young, among intellectuals and workers, in popular cultures, in development work, in social service, in education, and in international relations. The very visibility of Christianity has also generated a hostile reaction in some government circles. Most recently in Zhejiang province near Shanghai. In May of this year, government officials bulldozed the Sanjiang Church in Wenzhou, the cities that Christians sometimes call China's Jerusalem. The city just a little bit larger than Hong Kong and has a much larger Christian population. The Sanjiang Church ran into trouble even though it was part of the officially recognized church. The government claimed Sanjiang went over and above board in what had been approved. Crosses on top of other churches have also been taken down. Just 2 weeks ago, the major church in Hangzhou, in the capital of the province, had its cross taken down, and they were told the reason was because it was in a commercial district and it attracted too much attention. A friend of mine, a local pastor in the province, said that more than 150 crosses have been taken down and many churches have been destroyed. That number may be even higher now. Clearly, the government in Zhejiang fears the spreading influence of the church. The Sanjiang Church was torn down on orders of the provincial party secretary, but there's no evidence that this is happening in other provinces. Still, the actions of Zhejiang are against the spirit of openness, and they exemplify how local officials often override the law. Chinese Christians and human rights groups complain about other human rights violations. There have been many cases over the past decades of the abuse of religious freedom by local government officials. These include arbitrary arrests, beating of Christians, detaining of priests and bishops who outwardly express loyalty to the Vatican, the confiscation of religious literature, the breaking up of Christian gatherings, and the refusal to register churches. Sometimes bribes are extracted from what's perceived to be a wealthy Christian community. Local officials worry about the visibility of the churches, and some see a Christian potential for fomenting rebellion or political unrest. The disturbing thing about the demolition of crosses in Wenzhou is that the province itself has been one of the most tolerant provinces and the one with the largest percentage of Christians. The fact that that this was organized by a provincial official who was an ally of Xi Jinping is itself a cause for concern. Human rights have become more restrictive since Xi took office, but I don't see, at least not yet, any increasing national restrictions on religions. There are also tensions between Christianity and folk religions in some areas, not only with the government, but also with folk religions. And a lot has been written about that, so I'm not going to say anything more here, but simply that both of these combined show some cause that we have to be concerned about the future direction of government policy. Still, I would not want to generalize about the government repression of religion. In fact, I think that the government bureau in charge of religious affairs has often been more helpful rather than harmful to the church. When the head of the state administration of religious affairs recently said that Chinese should have their own belief system, he was emphasizing the need for the contextualization of theology so that Christians could appear to be less foreign. He was not saying that the government would construct this belief system in and of itself. And in fact, you can see in all of these publications that by Christians and by academics, they're talking about the need to make Christianity more Chinese. Churches could not have developed as quickly as they have in a totally hostile political environment. The policy of religious freedom is real enough. There is, however, a wide range of policy implementations that varies from place to place. Scholars have written that local governments often function with one eye open and one eye closed, an inconsistency that's built into the system. Officials pretend not to notice when religious groups violate regulations, as long as the religious groups themselves pretend to follow the rules. This provides space for experimentation, adherence to rules of quote-unquote normal religious practice, and also the possibility of a crackdown. The other eye could open up easily enough. Now, not all Chinese Christians pretend to follow the rules, nor are they willing to accept any limitation on their profession of faith. Some are quite courageous and speak publicly about abuses and limitations on religious freedom. They have chosen a path that inevitably leads to confrontation and conflict with the authorities. In one sense, I respect that choice. It's a Christian option that we have seen again and again in the history of the church, but it's by no means the only option that Christians have, and it's certainly not the majority opinion in China. To be sure, the government has tried to keep religion within certain bounds, but the boundaries have been expanding over the last decades, at least in most parts of China. And this growth is largely due to the persistence of Christians who have helped expand the boundaries. There's even an effort now to co-opt religion to contribute to the construction of a harmonious society. And as the government withdraws from social services, some religious groups, including the Christian-initiated Amity Foundation, which in fact may be the largest real non-governmental organization in China, have been asked to play a greater role in medical care, relief work, and social welfare. Please understand, I believe that the government and the party should open up religious policy and correct their own abuses. I'm not trying to justify the situation as it now exists. By opening up religious policy, it would strengthen China, contribute to a harmonious society, and help stabilize the system. However, even with continuing government supervision in China's authoritarian system, there is space for Christians to preach the gospel, develop the churches, and grow. Christianity can often thrive in a harsh political environment. We must recognize the difficulties that Christians face, but we should not exaggerate them. Even in Zhejiang, there's no evidence that the tearing down of crosses has reduced the number of people going to church. I tend to favor those who work for pragmatic responses to difficulties as they seek to live out their faith. Typical Anglican position. The limitations on the full exercise of religious freedom has not prevented the growth and development of the Chinese church in a variety of forms. I said at the beginning of my talk that I've been following the situation in China for more than 30 years. In the early 1980s, I was living in Nanjing, and I wrote then about what it was like. Very different from what it is today. Then there were few churches, few Bibles, few pastors. Religious policy was extremely restrictive. Only one Protestant seminary was open in the country, and only one Catholic seminary. Many people had lingering fears that a cultural revolution might recur. Christianity had no public visibility, and the church continued to be criticized by academics as a tool of imperialist cultural aggression. No one then could have imagined what it would be like today. As a theologian, I'm optimistic about the Christian future. Christians do not easily give up. We're patient. I believe Christianity will continue to develop in China in both old and new ways. It will become more pluralistic, less unified, more sophisticated, less foreign, and all the while more interesting. Chinese Christians will have to negotiate all of the obstacles they face, but this is normal. It's been the situation in the church for more than 2,000 years, and China will be no different. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wickery, for that overview of the challenges facing Christianity and some of the issues. First of all, is there any sign that the authorities, for example, in Zhejiang, are focusing on Protestants versus Catholics? Is there any sign of a broader crackdown on other non-Christian faiths? How much of this do you think is targeted? How narrowly or how broadly is this being targeted at religious expression in Zhejiang?
This seems to be targeted mainly at the growth of Protestant Christianity, which is the major religion in Zhejiang. There was a Catholic church that burned down a few months ago, but that was due to natural causes, I understand. One of the interesting things about this is the convergence between some of the community-based Christians and the institutional church, because they all feel the pressure, and it has helped them come together a little bit more. In Wenzhou, there have also been some of the folk religious shrines and temples that have been destroyed, so that this is not exclusively something that's directed at Christians. It certainly, Protestant Christians, but that certainly seems to be the target at this point.
Dr. Wickery, thanks very much. I'm Tara Joseph with Reuters. You mentioned towards the end of your talk about looking for pragmatic responses. When you think of the international community or the international Christian community, what do you think is a pragmatic response?
I'm talking mainly about pragmatic responses within China itself. The Chinese Christians have not issued any calls for support from the international community. And that includes not only the institutional church, but the home-based groups as well. Pragmatic responses mean, okay, a lot has been written about the Shouwang Church in Beijing, which has its own building. They've wanted to be registered, but the government has not allowed them to. They continue to meet. They're under a lot of pressure, but they're not, sort of making this into a huge outcry, asking for everyone else's support. That's an example of a pragmatic response.
Just if I can follow up on that, clearly the Western media and the mainstream media is full of stories of churches being shut down, Christians being arrested. Do you think that's being alarmist? Do you think people are being too alarmist outside of China as to what's happening there?
I don't think it's alarmist because, as I've tried to say, these things have happened, and I could detail them in many places. Zhejiang is significant because it has up until now been one of the most open provinces in China, not because of it being one of the closed ones. But what I would say that it's being a little bit one-sided, that yes, there are these acts of repression, but this is not the only thing. There are other parts of the story, and it's you usually only read about that in the newspaper when Christmas time comes and we hear about the worship services that are overflowing in many, many different places.
With that, let me open the floor to questions. Please identify yourselves, and why don't we start in the far corner there and then start working our way across.
Hi, excuse me. Moira Shaw from Agence France-Presse. I want to know what you think about the difference between Catholicism and Protestantism in China, and whether or not Catholicism has a bigger challenge because of the Vatican and the Pope and the institutional structure of the church compared to Protestantism, and whether or not that makes it more difficult for them to develop, evolve, and reach some kind of plateau of acceptance. Yeah.
I think I'd agree with what you said about the difficulties that Roman Catholics face, both primarily because of the relations with the Holy See. There are on-again, off-again conversations mediated by the Italian embassy between the Vatican and China, but these have been stalled for a number of years. The Catholic Church in China has not experienced phenomenal growth. I don't know if that's because, I don't know all of the reasons for that, but it has largely been a more family, community-based thing, reaching out to old Catholic families. But that's not entirely the case everywhere. As more and more intellectuals become interested in Catholicism, they're also drawn to that.
Okay, next here, please.
Dr. Ri, thank you first for an excellent talk. My name is Mark O'Neill. I, as you may know, I published this book about grandfather, and we have a simplified character edition. So whenever I go to China, I do some marketing. So one day I went to the Zhuhai Protestant Church. I wasn't quite sure if I was in the right place, and a young lady was there. I asked her, is this the place? She said, oh, don't give it to them. They're the government. Give it to me. I belong to a family church. So we had a 30-minute conversation. And she said they meet every Sunday in a wedding company. The outside is a wedding company. She said, we have no association with the official church, and they have one very charismatic pastor that you mentioned. So what I want to ask is, in all these family churches, who is the minister? Where is his training? What kind of theology does he have? And are they in contact with each other, or are they all just operating alone? Thank you.
Yeah, this is what I was trying to mention about the tension between the community-based or the family church or the house church and the so-called official church. In some areas, the tensions are great indeed, and they refuse to talk to one another, as you've said. In other areas, it's a very gray kind of thing, that there's overlapping. People go to both of these. Who are the pastors? There's not an ordination process in most of the family churches. The Chinese church overall is largely a lay-led church. This frustrates people like Anglicans when we like to see more priests ordained and so forth, but that notwithstanding, that is in fact the reality of what's happening even in the official church in China, the tremendous amount of lay leadership. The theologies between the churches, the belief system, the sermons, are not all that different.
Okay. In the corner, and then we'll come around here next.
I'm Tohan Shi, a reporter from the South China Morning Post. Back to the Zhejiang issue, should we take at face value the official explanation that the crosses and the buildings violated the building code, which is why they're torn down? And if we should not take that at face value, what is really the underlying motive for taking down the crosses and churches? And what do you think is the wisest way for Christians to respond in such a situation?
I do not believe this is that the taking down of crosses is violating some law that hasn't even been written. The cross that was just taken down at the Gulo Church in Hangzhou, a church that I've worshipped in many times, it's been there for years and years. So how can it be violating something? There's no new law about this. So I don't take what the government is saying there at face value. I think that this is a violation of religious freedom, and it's the government fear is that this is the spreading influence of Christianity. One report had it that the party secretary was traveling along a highway and saw several churches in the Wenzhou area with huge crosses on top, and he was concerned about this and mentioned it to an aide, and then this precipitated the beginning earlier this year of taking down these crosses. This is one area in which many Christians from overseas, including Archbishop Paul, our Archbishop, have written to the government saying that what's going on here, this seems to be a violation of religious freedom. Please clarify. I don't know of any responses that have come yet.
Wayne here, please.
Wayne Nieminen, Lutheran Theological Seminary. And I'm wondering if you're aware of the of any internal debate within the party as far as Christianity and different religions. Are all seen equally as equally, or is there more hostility towards Islam or Christianity?
Yeah, there are there are documents that are available about these internal debates. Probably they're at a very almost public level within China, and there are debates about policy that the government should follow in this. There's certainly a greater concern about Islam than about any of the other religions, and there's a kind of easy acceptance of Buddhism, Taoism, and the so-called Chinese religions. So there is this debate that's going on within the party and the government, and as a result of this, there's a lot of the problems, I will contend, are problems with the implementation of what on the face value seems to be a rather open policy of religious freedom. And so if you go further inland or to more remote areas, you have more restrictions on religion than you used to do in places like Zhejiang. But again, let me say in Zhejiang, the people are still going to church, the crosses have come down, but there's no, that has not affected the believers, the Christians going to churches.
Okay. Next, please, right here.
Andrew McGeoch, a lawyer. Just in that context of crosses are very visible, and is it a fear of the visibility? You commented on that rather than that they're fearing the growth of Christianity in China. Is it just that pure visibility?
The words used by the party secretary were 扩大影响, that expand the influence of Christianity because of the visibility of the crosses.
Do we have questions over here? I don't mean to be neglecting. Yes, here, right here, please.
Maureen Zab, I'm affiliated with Hong Kong University. British newspapers have commented on the rise of a kind of aggressive secularism in society, concern about that, particularly from Cameron and his officials, and a hostility towards Christians who give witness to their faith or who wear iconic symbols like crucifixes around their neck. In contrast, what you've been talking about is the growth of Christianity in China, but how would you account for that? I know it's a very large question, but could you perhaps suggest some of the reasons for that growth? Thank you.
Again, this is something that many of us have been following for many, many years. And I think, to give a simple response to a very complicated question, it would be as a result of the spiritual vacuum created after the end of the Cultural Revolution, and as a result of the growing influence of the importance of money and, sort of crass material values in the years of openness and reform, some people are saying, wait a minute, is this all there is to it? One used to be able to say that Christianity was only growing among this sounds a little patronizing, but they're not my word, among the poor, the marginalized, the women, the illiterate, and the sick, that these were the places where Christianity was growing. But that's not true anymore. It's also growing among the rich businessmen, among the intellectuals, among the entertainers, among students, and so forth. And I think they find something worthwhile there. What is St. Augustine? Our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. I think that's always a reason for the growth of Christianity.
What about party officials? Do they still discourage anybody who is a party member, 60, 70 million people, from joining any religious affiliation whatsoever?
Yes, they do. It's according to the most recent party constitution, it doesn't say anything about religion, but it says you must be a materialist. So theologians argue that, well, I can be a materialist and a Christian at the same time. But in terms of party officials, with the singular exception of Islam, I said, well, why Islam is accepted? Well, because we wouldn't have any party officials in the far West if we excluded Muslims from being part of the party. That said, that there are many party officials that really admire the Christians. One of the scholars I quoted dedicated his book to his late father, who had been a dedicated party official all of his life, and on his deathbed converted to Christianity. There are many examples of this.
Do you see any sign at the national level of a shift in stance?
No. No, I don't. I do not. And we, there are so many people working on this that we would notice this immediately. I don't see any shift in stance.
But could Zhejiang happen without national approval?
Yes.
There? You think it could, be autonomous?
Yeah, it could, because it happens in other places. Now, the thing that worries me about this, in the early 1990s, there was no system of registration of churches. And that system of registration began in Guangdong province. And the interpretation of many, well, this is a Guangdong local development. And then two or three years later, it was expanded to include the whole country, and then we get the emergence of national religious laws about the registration of churches, I can work with that. Many Christians can work with that, but others cannot. Now, is what's happening in Zhejiang a trial balloon? I'm not willing to say that it is, but that's a concern that's in the back of my mind about this.
And what about church-affiliated social groups, social welfare groups? I visited quite a few years ago a Catholic orphanage in Guangdong, but it was low profile. What is your sense on whether, even if they are still discouraging missionaries, whether they're becoming more open to those social welfare groups?
No, the largest Catholic social welfare organization is in Hebei province, and they have very good political connections, and it's led by this indefatigable nun who wanted to have government. What they do is they work with sort of discarded children, quote unquote, who have been left by the roadside and who often will never be adopted because they have physical deformities or something. And so she went to the government and asked for money to help support these children. And they said, well, they can't see you now. So she went back every day for weeks with two children in her hand. And finally they saw her. It's like the biblical story about the woman who eventually wears down the unjust judge and they relent, and so this happened. So I think that the social welfare organizations, sometimes they're low-key, but more often now they're called upon to help. Like in the earthquake in Yunnan province, there are many social welfare groups in China that are helping there, and that's all welcome.
Okay, maybe one last question over here, and then we need to wrap up.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm Lee. I'm also a member of the FCC here. As you say, okay, the suppression may come with the increase of the followers. It's something like that happened 2,000 years ago in Rome. Now, you know, the Christianity is, I have a question out there, but just give a little bit of background. The Christianity and Chinese people as a whole, okay, have been in a lot of tension, okay, in the past 200 years, especially. Because a lot of people still tie the Christianity with the humiliation of the country. Even in today, the Chinese history textbook in China still teaches that opium and Bibles came on the same boat, right? Especially in the 19th century. And now they have, but they also look at the fact. Now the Christianity, you know, Catholic, Protestant, whatever combined, have a larger population than the party base, party membership today. I can easily believe that should be a, you know. And in that case, that the calling, as Keith just mentioned, a calling for a state religion is not a wild, too wild idea. Maybe some people in Beijing have to face this. Okay, how do they solve the loyalty? In their own mind, they think the Christian may not be loyal to the country, okay, given the history of the past two centuries. Given you are from Anglican background, I just a wild question. Would that be practical for China to consider, I mean, have the Chinese version of an Anglican church? I mean, just like Xi Jinping did something what the Henry VIII did, set up the Sinulcan church, and then make the head of country be the head of church, like what Queen Elizabeth still today. And then in future, then make them be comfortable, okay, if China in war, then at least the king and God are on the same side. Okay. Or the God and king, you know, whatever order.
Okay, just the first part of your question first. There is this long history of anti-Christian feelings and the association of Christianity with gunboat diplomacy. It's not only in Chinese textbooks that appears. That appears in English language textbooks as well. But the association of Christianity and opium, one of the things that made possible the growth of Christianity from the government side was the 1982 statement on religion, which for the first time did not mention religion as an opiate. That was an enormous thing, so that Christianity was no longer associated with opium. The discussions that I've heard in academic circles in China about religion and state religion and so forth have usually focused on Confucianism as a possible state religion, even though they debate whether it's a religion at all. In terms of whether I don't think I can really comment on whether there can be an Anglican version of Christianity in China, because that's not what we're trying to do here in the church. But I don't see in any kind of reasonable expectation or hope or even desire to have this kind of a state religion. Christians all over the world have tried to live down the kind of Constantinian captivity of the church now that we in a very, very different kind of age. So thank you for your question.
Well, from St. Augustine to the Constantinian captivity, that has been a fascinating lecture. Thank you all for coming. We'd like to give all of our speakers something to remember the club by.
Okay, thank you.
And we hope to see you soon back at the club in your club tie.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Thank you all. Thank you all for coming.
Can I just do one thing briefly? Just, I brought two props that I didn't show. This is a New Testament that was copied by hand during the Cultural Revolution in 1967, in Wenzhou, where they're taking down the cross. Hand-copied New Testament. That's what it was then. This is the 100 million Bible that we produced at the Amity Foundation in Nanjing. It's a beautiful Bible, all done in bamboo with special symbolism. But the cool thing about this is the box that it comes in. Inside the box, there's this little fish, the loaves and fishes from the New Testament, and there's a USB drive that has the entire Bible on the USB drive. So one of the reasons that the purchase of Bible in cities is going down is because people would rather read this on their iPad or whatever versions they have to read the electronic version.
I can hold up the box so you can see the box.
Yeah, here's the box, and here's the Bible. This is a replica of the first ones, first Bibles printed in China after the end of the Cultural Revolution. So it's in the complex characters, traditional characters. Now almost all Bibles are produced in simplified characters.